grateful member of Al-Anon for 15 years now. Thank you, Alex. Thank you for your share. Thank you for being here. For everyone here and on Zoom, thank you for coming to hear me share my experience, strength, and hope with you tonight. I tried to come up with a theme so that I stay a little more focused because I can meander a little bit and I have lots of experience, strength, and hope to share. So my theme for this is really going to be about powerlessness because I think that a lot of people come into the program with a confusion about powerlessness. Is this good here? Okay. The idea of surrendering, the idea of letting go feels, I've heard people say for alcoholics, doesn't that just mean they're saying it's not my problem? I can't do anything about it. It's not, it wasn't my fault. And people will say, is that a cop out? And for Al-Anons, they might think that surrendering is saying that I'm just abdicating responsibility for my loved ones, my children, and my spouse, the people that I love. Am I supposed to just do that? Letting go sounds like just giving up. And I really feel like that's a misunderstanding of what that concept is. And getting into program, I learned a lot about that. And I would say that the program has given me the gift of true empowerment, which paradoxically is what we get when we come into Al-Anon. We learn to let go of trying to have control over people, places, and things, and we learn how to feel empowered in ourselves and in knowing ourselves and in our own truth of who we are, and it has nothing to do with trying to control other people. So that's what I'm going to try to focus on as I tell my story. And I think the thing about power is that power structures set us up to have a winner and a loser. And that's certainly the kind of power that was modeled for me when I looked at my parents as I was growing up. I don't like to label my father as an alcoholic, but when I look back, he did drink a lot and he did exhibit behaviors that were erratic, and it was hard to know how when he was going to blow his fuse and when he was going to yell. And I saw him yelling and I would see him lose his temper. He would be silly and we'd all be laughing, and then the too much laughing, too much noise, he would just want to shut it down or tell my mom to tell us to cut it out. He seemed to be afraid of emotions, so too much laughter or too much crying, he would like to get a rise out of us, push buttons, and then he would, then if I started to cry, he would say, "Lighten up." So I learned early on that my emotions were not welcome, and that I should maybe be afraid of them myself. Meanwhile, my mom would often be the one to be yelled at, and I would see her in the kitchen crying. And she never spoke up for herself. She never fought back. And I looked at that and I thought, well, I'm going to be like my dad. I don't want to be the one who's crying in the kitchen. And I thought that those were my two options. I grew up with a lot of black and white thinking. And I also learned by watching my mom that there was another way to have power in a relationship, and that was through manipulation. So my mom, I would watch her try to soften things for my dad. If we needed something, she would find the right time to ask him and watch his moods. We learned to watch his moods very carefully. So I picked up on some of those techniques as well over the years. Now, for me, there were a lot of illusions of power that I clung on to for many years. And I think just after years of Al-Anon and therapy, I understand my need for control in what was not always outwardly chaotic, but inwardly chaotic place to be. So one power of illusion for me was the power of persuasion. I had an experience as a child that made me think that I had a lot of power to change somebody who was addicted. I was really upset after learning at school about about how cigarettes could kill. And I came home from school and thought, well, I'm just going to reason with my dad about his smoking. So I sat down with a pad of paper and I tried to do the math with him about how many cigarettes take how many years off your life. And I was trying to explain all of that. And he said, you're right. I've been meaning to quit. I'm gonna quit. I'm gonna quit on March 14th. And he gave me a lot of credit for that. And looking back, I know that he was probably ready, because I know if he wasn't ready to quit, he wouldn't have quit. But I walked away thinking, wow, I can reason with someone and I can get them to quit. When I went off to college, I left my father's house, went into a dorm, and I met my husband. And that was pretty swift. We didn't get married right away, but for the 4 years that we dated, I chose to think that his marijuana use was going to be no problem for me. I didn't know anything about really the family disease. I'd had a little exposure to the fact that my aunt was in AA, and I saw that it made her life better. But I didn't really know much more about it. I knew that lots of my aunts and uncles on my dad's side smoked cigarettes and drank, and I said, I better be careful because I know it runs in the family. But what I didn't know runs in the family is codependency, because I didn't even know what codependency was. So I jumped into this relationship with someone who was giving me love and attention and a sense of self-worth that I was looking for outside of me. And we fell in love. And when I was very naive. I had never even really been around marijuana. When I first found out he had been smoking it and that he had lied to me, I thought I could reason with him. Well, why did you lie to me? I don't have a problem with it. And so for the next several years, I would hang out with him and the other people in our dorm who liked to smoke out, and we'd play cards, and everybody would pass the bong around, and I would just say no because I knew I didn't want to do it for me. And thank God I knew that for myself. But I was trying to play this game where I could act like I'm cool with this, it's going to be fine. And all the while, I was breeding resentment because I wanted to be front and center in his life. And I thought I was competing with the marijuana. And I thought if he loved me, he would give it up, or pretty soon he'll grow out of it, or once we're married, or once we have a kid. It didn't quite happen that way. So I was breeding resentment and feeling like a victim. And I tried another type of power, the power of suggestion. I would try to place articles and books around the house, usually in the bathroom, if I was going to hope he would read anything, it would happen there. And I would try to make appeals to his emotions. I would try to make appeals to his sense of duty as a father. And, those things didn't work. So I thought I had a lot of power, but I'm just wondering if I thought I had so much power, why wasn't it working? It wasn't working. I was very self-seeking, looking outside of myself for my happiness. And ironically, that turned all that power right over to somebody else. And I learned that later once I was in Al-Anon. I tried nagging. I would obsess over solutions to this problem. I was a detective sniffing out pot. When he switched to Vicodin, I couldn't smell that anymore. So it was a lot harder to be a detective. It was a lot of denial for me. We did a lot of dancing around this. Things would flare up. I would lose my temper. I would yell, stomp out of the room. I once took a hammer to his pipe that I found hidden in the barbecue. I was out of control, and he would do things to appease me and make me think I won for the moment. And then things would simmer down because I wanted to be in denial. I wanted to believe that things were going to be okay now. And I believed I had the power to make that happen. Somehow along the way, I ended up with a really twisted concept of what powerlessness is. I had picked up on the fact that an addict needs to want to quit. And somehow I thought, though, I could make him want it. So I tried to bring that about and speed that along. You know, some of the things I already mentioned by putting pamphlets out there. Can we go on a marriage retreat? I was blaming him and his marijuana and other drug use for all of my unhappiness. And it's kind of tricky. I was able to say, well, I'm powerless. I'm powerless over this. So I can just sit here and stew and resent and blame him for it all and wait, just wait for him to realize what I thought he needed to do. I also had developed a twisted sense of what boundaries were. And as I first started trying out boundaries, I realized I was using them to seek some kind of power and control by setting down rules for other people instead of figuring out what I needed for me. One example was that we were already married and we had a couple of kids, and I had started to notice that I didn't really like my dad's drinking, and I didn't like the way he was when he would come to visit and kind of check out. And so now that the stakes were a lot lower with my dad because I wasn't living with him anymore, I thought I could try to flex some of that power I had and call the shots in my own home. So I wrote him a letter and told him that I wasn't going to allow him to have alcohol in our home anymore. And when he would come to visit, we would hide our alcohol out in the backyard. And he abided by that, but he was really angry about it. And I'd like to say that that was me setting a healthy boundary, but I know the truth. I know that that was me maybe partially setting a healthy boundary and feeling like I should do that to protect my kids. But also I was punishing my dad and I was trying to get a sense of power. So that was not a healthy boundary. With my husband, when we would play that game and have that dance, we would negotiate. So I'd say, well, if you want to smoke pot, fine, but just not here at our house. So you need to go to your brother's or you need to go somewhere else. And then I would catch him doing it at our house. And then I'd have to do the dance all over again. And it was always me saying, well, if that wasn't working for you, why did you feel like you had to lie and sneak? Why didn't you just tell me? I would have negotiated with you. That's not working for you. Let's come up with something else. And the line that I was drawing, I just kept moving it closer to me until I wasn't taking up very much space in the room, even though I could yell a lot. And I was definitely controlling and bossy. So I got into Al-Anon, and for a little while there, I was confused about this idea of control. I was afraid now to say anything because I was thinking that I was trying to control. I didn't want to dominate, nag, scold, or complain anymore. So then I just stopped saying anything for a little while. But I kept working the program and soon learned what a true sense of empowerment is, which is not about a winner and a loser. Empowerment is about knowing oneself and living in the truth of who I am and being honest about what my motives are and knowing what I need and taking care of my own needs. I learned about self-care in Al-Anon, which was really difficult at first because it seemed selfish to me. But I watched other people share about their self-care, and I started to make choices for me, going to the gym, finding recreation and hobbies. And I had to learn how to identify my emotions because of partially because of the way I'd grown up. Logic and reasoning really worked for me. I became very high functioning, straight A student. That was a good way to get my dad's attention. Meanwhile, what withered for me was a sense of my emotional side. So Al-Anon helped me learn how to figure out what my emotions were and what my needs were and what my wants were. When I worked my fourth step, the way we do it here in Al-Anon, we look not just at our defects, but at our assets. And that's a way of getting a balanced, true picture of oneself. And I believe that that is where we find true humility, is when we're able to say what's good about us as well as what's bad. And that was part of me coming to know who I was. The other way to live in truth is to accept what is and to be able to live in the present moment, which I could never do before and still struggle with my obsessive thinking and future tripping. But I used to do it a lot more. And now I'm able to live in the present moment more frequently or catch myself. And I know that that's where I want to be when I start each day, even if I do slip into a little bit of future tripping. And I found that once I learned about myself and could identify my emotions and get at what my motives were, maybe work a step around something before reacting, and finding myself defensive rather than jumping to my defense, just waiting or talking to a sponsor, I realized then that I could voice my truth and I could speak up. And somebody taught me early on in Al-Anon that I had a right to voice my truth and to let people know how their behavior was affecting me. I could do that one time. But if I found myself repeating it, now I was trying to control that person. And so I learned that. And so I knew if I only had one shot at speaking my truth, I should really stop and think about what that is before I go and speak it. And I learned that I had some choices once I figured out what was bothering me. I could change my own behavior. I could act, do an act of self-care. I could reach out to someone. Or I could choose to do nothing, which is actually a very empowering choice once I shifted my attitude and realized I'm not doing nothing out of denial. I'm doing nothing because I'm choosing to wait. And I have reasons for it. As I continued to move out of my black and white thinking, I learned from another friend in Al-Anon that there are third options. I was so black and white about things, but I learned that there are some things that solutions and creative ways that I could meet my needs. I have an example of that from when I worked step 9. At that point, I knew I needed to make an amends to my dad, because what I had done was pretty much written him off. He hadn't turned out to be the dad that I had hoped for. And so I figured in that black and white thinking that, well, it's useless at this point. But I did figure out that I had a part to play in that, in writing him off, and that I wanted to make an amends about it. And that even though it wasn't going to be perfect, or the relationship that I thought I should have, it could be something better than it was, and that would be worth it. And so I made my amends with my dad, and we ended up talking on the phone every Sunday for 7 years in 1 month before he died of pancreatic cancer. And I will tell you that that is the greatest gift this program has given me. It's not the fact that my husband is clean and has been clean for 8 years. That almost feels incidental at this point, even though that's what brought me into the program. I know that that could end any day. But what I got with my dad was the best gift of the program, because when he died, I did not have any regrets. And we had a much better relationship than I thought I ever would have had. And those phone calls, sometimes he really annoyed me. He was still the same person, but I had the choice to end the call, or oftentimes it was surprising. And I think the program allows me to be surprised by different outcomes and by people, by letting people have their own reactions. Because when I offered that to him, he was open to it. And we often would talk on the phone for an hour, and I would share my latest parenting problems with him. And when I decided to change my career, he was my biggest champion, checking in with me every week about how that was going and telling me that he believed in me. Some of the things that I've gotten from this true empowerment is that I know when I need to make amends because I'm in tune with my feelings. I know when I have that hungover feeling that my behavior has caused something, that I need to do something about that. And I found so much liberation in being able to admit when I'm wrong. I'm sure my husband would tell you that's one of my biggest defects is I don't like to be wrong. And at some point, I don't know when, but I will say during my fourth step, I realized this about myself. I had started equating being wrong about anything on the same level of moral wrong. So if I was wrong about something, I was feeling so low about it, like making a mistake was like a sin or something. And program opened my eyes to that. And it's so nice to be able to just say to someone, you might be right, and let that go, or to just say, yeah, I was wrong, and just promptly admit it and move on. So I love the 10th step. I've learned to have more trust in myself now and in my higher power because my higher power got me into program. And I know that my higher power will keep me out of denial. So I don't need to worry because I was really worried I was going to fall back into denial. But that's another gift the program's given me. No matter what happens, I have these tools and I know what I know. And I'm probably in denial right now about something else, and it'll be revealed when it's time. I learned that if I don't like a dynamic that I'm in, I can change myself because I'm part of that dynamic. And if I change myself, that dynamic is going to change necessarily. There's just no other way. That's the definition of it. I don't get to decide how the dynamic's going to change, though, because the other people who are a part of it have to choose how they're going to react to my changes. So I learned true boundaries finally. And I learned that a boundary comes when it wells up inside of me. I know it and I feel it because I know that I've crossed it or I've let someone cross it. And it's not about a punishment. It's about me realizing that I can't stand for something anymore. And that did happen to me in 2015. So I got into program in 2008 after trying to do an intervention without any program, without really understanding the disease. And the intervention did not stick with my husband, but it stuck with me because I got into program. I got into 12-step because of it. The next 7 years were the biggest growth period of my life, and I'm so grateful for those 7 years. But in 2015, I was 39. I was about 6 months away from my 40th birthday. And I don't know what happened. Just that day it clicked. And I looked at my life and I thought about what's going to happen when I'm approaching 50 in 10 years from now. And I thought, I don't want the same life I have right now. I don't want what I have right now. It's just not enough. I had been trying to use the tools of the program to maintain the marriage and to achieve serenity with active addiction in the house, which could be possible. It's one choice. It's an avenue to take, and I needed to take it. There were a lot of stakes. We had four young children, and especially in 2008 when I first tried that intervention. And the problem with that one was that an intervention involves an ultimatum, and I wasn't wi really willing to follow through on that one. And we know that you can't make threats you don't intend to carry out. But in 2015, I felt something different and I knew it was time. So We did separate for 8 months. I didn't know how long we were going to be separating, and I didn't know what the outcome was going to be. That's where that powerlessness came in, and I had to let go. I didn't know even what I wanted to see or what I needed to see from my husband. I knew that he needed to figure that out for himself. I didn't know if he was going to want to keep the marriage. I know I had hope and wanted it to work out, but we just had to wait and see, and I didn't know what I was going to feel or how the timing was going to work. But gratefully, he did find his own program. And 8 months after he moved out, I asked him to move back in, and we are doing fine. But as I said, that is really almost incidental at this point, because when I look at the gifts of the program, for me, the things that truly last are not the things that are outside of me that I thought I needed to happen for my happiness. But it's the tools that I'm learning and continue to learn that I know are going to help me through anything that is to come. And there are probably going to be a lot of things to come. And I learned that from being in the rooms and hearing the shares of other people and just watching my own family grow up. Al-Anon's given me an openness to imagine a better life. And for me, surrendering means that I'm a willing participant in my own recovery. I'm eager to see what's next. And I'm seeking what my part is in that, and I'm doing my footwork. So if anyone thinks that powerlessness is just a cop-out or just an abdication, has got it all wrong, in my opinion, because there's a lot of work. Al-Anons are some of the hardest working people and the most self-reflective and rigorously honest people I've ever met. And it's hard work, but it's work that I'm so proud of. How am I doing on time here? We're okay. Okay. Another gift of the program is that during that 8 months, I guess I figured that'd also be a good time to quit my job that I had for 19 years. And I think my higher power was saying, you know what, we got that distraction off your plate. It's time to look at some other things. And I had already started doing tiny baby steps of footwork to the dream of someday becoming a teacher. But all of these things started happening. And next thing I knew, I had accepted a semester-long substitute job. It started on my 40th birthday. And I quit my 19-year-plus job in order to give that my all. And from there, I've never looked back. And I can't even believe that I had the courage to do that. I was intimidated by teenagers, and now I teach high school. But that's been another wonderful gift of the program. I'm almost done. I feel so much less reactive now, and I'm able to detach with love, which is one of the handiest tools as a parent. I have my kids growing up, and I'm so grateful that this program has given me the ability to love all of you for all the different choices you make and all the different values that you hold and all the different journeys that you're on, because I can apply that to my own children and respect that they are on their own journey and that's not for me to control. And that when I allow them to make mistakes or what I might think are mistakes, I'm allowing them that opportunity to learn and grow just like I have. And that's also, I believe, how they find their own boundaries is when they make a mistake and cross one. So for me, all of this is what empowerment is about. And again, it's not about power over others. It's just something that comes from within. And it's all the different tools and principles of the program that instill that in us one day at a time. I didn't even see it coming. It's just in looking back and reflecting that I'm able to realize it. So that's it for me, and I thank you so much for letting me share.